Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, interesting development amid the ongoing opioid crisis. The U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Jerome Adams, has issued a national advisory to the nation that all people who are close to someone at risk for overdose be equipped with a ready dose of naloxone, the highly effective antidote to overdoses. It's an interesting idea in the wake of the opioid crisis, which shows no sign of slowing down.
Well, Mark, it's an absolutely pragmatic idea. You know, the responsibility for this has fallen on first responders, both the police and, of course, the EMTs who are called to the scene of an overdose. But communities are overrun with the opioid crisis. Budgets are being tapped out just from stockpiling naloxone, which is also known as Narcan. And perhaps most importantly, there can be a lag time between a 911 call placed by a family member, a friend, or a loved one, or even a bystander, and the naloxone being administered in time. So having friends or family members nearby who are equipped and trained to administer the antidote has saved lives and would save more lives if we followed the Surgeon General's recommendation.
And Margaret, it's a terrible tragedy that roughly 115 people are dying by overdose every day in this country. The Surgeon General noted that while policymakers are working to put better strategies in place to address the overall crisis, this will save lives in the short run.
Mark, this conversation reminds me of a former guest on the show, Dr. Leanna Wen, remember? Baltimore's
yes.
Health Commissioner. She issued a standing prescription at all of the region's pharmacies for anybody who wanted to obtain naloxone. Very successful program, but it's also deleted supplies. They've actually had to start rationing the antidote in their city, which is just unconscionable in the midst of this public health crisis.
The amount of money being spent on rehab for those struggling with addiction has gone up noticeably in the past year. Insurers have been reluctant to approve paying for rehab and other mental health services, so this is a positive change.
Speaking of insurance coverage, Mark, as we know, the administration cut this past year's open enrollment period in half and spent very little money marketing the Affordable Care Act. But still, a lot of people did become enrolled. Unfortunately, it left a lot of other people uninformed about their insurance options. According to the latest numbers, about 400,000 fewer Americans signed up for health coverage, and that is of great concern to us as well as to our guest today. Deborah Ness is the president of the National Partnership for Women and Families. It's a nonprofit dedicated to improving access to healthcare for all Americans, and her organization was instrumental in helping to craft a number of key elements of the Affordable Care Act. So we're very interested to hear her thoughts on the current state of healthcare and health reform in the United States.
And we're also interested in listening to Lori Robertson, who stops by. She's the managing editor of FactCheck.org, who looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, of course, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love to hear from you. We'll get to our interview with Deborah Ness of the National Partnership for Women and Families in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. What is the most concerning topic on the minds of American voters? In the HuffPost YouGov poll of 1,000 U.S. adults, healthcare topped all other subjects as primary concerns for those planning to vote in the upcoming election. According to the poll, 30% of those polled listed healthcare as their number one concern. Gun legislation and immigration received about 25% each. Democratic pollsters have been gauging Americans' reaction to the myriad attempts by the GOP leadership and the Trump administration to undo the Affordable Care Act, which has actually steadily gained in popularity among Americans over the past several years. Meanwhile, according to a Kaiser Family Foundation poll, most Americans who purchase insurance coverage on the exchanges say health coverage and the peace of mind from being covered are the primary reasons why they purchase coverage, not because of the individual mandate that required all Americans to have coverage or pay a penalty. 61% of those polled said they were satisfied with their health plans. A majority of those polled, however, are worried about what will happen to their health coverage as they watch repeated attempts to undermine the law. State-based races in places like Kentucky could be impacted by health care decisions. 400,000 state residents gained coverage under the Medicaid expansion in that state under the previous governor, but are now seeing efforts to curtail those gains and force things like work requirements for those receiving Medicaid under the current governor. And they say it could prove a challenge for Republicans seeking office in that state in the upcoming election. Meanwhile, Virginia appears poised to enact Medicaid expansion in that state, which could lead to health coverage for some 400,000 poor and working poor residents in that state. Enough Republican voters in the state have switched away from the party line to endorse the measure, with some caveats, however. Two Republican state senators have said they will vote in favor of Medicaid expansion. The details of the final deal are being worked out. If approved, Virginia would become the 34th state to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. Healthcare spending, meanwhile, does continue to be a cause for concern for all health consumers and state governments having to foot those bills with few controls over pricing. California is launching a measure, a bill that would give the state power to set healthcare costs across the board, from hospital pricing to doctor's visits. They're expecting a significant pushback and powerful battle from the hospital and medical lobbies. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Deborah Ness, president of the National Partnership for Women and Families, a nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy group dedicated to promoting fairness in the workplace and access to quality health care for all. Prior to that, Ms. Ness served as executive vice president of the National Partnership. Ms. Ness served on the executive committees of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights and is a member of the board of directors at the National Committee for Quality Assurance, NCQA. She is one of the first public members of the American Board of Internal Medicine Board of Directors. She earned her undergraduate degree in psychology and sociology from Drew University and her master's of science from Columbia University School of Social Work. Deborah, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
You know, we just marked the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said that of all of the forms of inequality, injustice in healthcare is the most shocking and inhumane. And for nearly 50 years, your organization has been advocating for policies that eliminate health disparities and really focused in on women and children. And you've been a major force behind many important policy initiatives that have advanced the cause of health equality in this country. And I wonder if you could highlight some of the most important healthcare issues women have faced and what role the National Partnership for Women and Families played in addressing some of these issues.
Well, I'll start by really reinforcing what Dr. King said. It's unconscionable to think about people not getting basic health care they need in a country like the United States of America. And we have made progress, but we still have such a long way to go. When I think about the progress that we've made, particularly from a women's lens, there are quite a number of really important steps we've taken. One of the most fundamental came out of Supreme Court decisions, like Roe v. Wade, giving women the ability to have autonomy over their reproductive health and destiny. Most women understand how important access to contraception and family planning services, access to safe legal abortion services if needed, really is to their ability to operate with equality and to be fully participatory in our society. It affects your education, it affects your ability to be in the workplace, and it affects your ability to space your family for the well-being of the whole family. That is one of the more fundamentally important steps forward for women. I think about Medicare and Medicaid as two extraordinarily important programs in ensuring that the people in this country get health care regardless of income. I would say that if we didn't have Medicare in place, and you think about how many people struggle to make ends meet when they retire, and if you had to add the complete cost of health care to that, so many more people would be living in poverty, particularly women. And Medicaid is an enormous part of our health care net. It is responsible for paying for more than half of the births in this country, and it also paid for the, it's the primary funder of family planning services for mm-hmm. women in this mm-hmm. country, and it also covers the other end of the spectrum. It's the primary source for paying for nursing home care. Mm-hmm. And again, 6 out of 10 nursing home residents are women. Talking about the progress we've made, the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, that we've been fighting over the past year, that too was an extraordinary breakthrough for this country. It expanded coverage for millions of people, and it also expanded Medicaid for millions. And it became an important way of lowering what was really a pretty shameful uninsured rate in this country. We still do have the highest rate of uninsured of any modern country in the world. So those are all pieces of progress, but we're fighting still sometimes to hold on to what we've already gotten. As much as we've gained in the way of coverage, one of the things that we're painfully aware of is the extent to which we have real disparities in how people get health care and how they fare with that health care across gender and across race and ethnicity and socioeconomic lines. We know that in the United States, black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from a pregnancy-related complication than white women. We know there are huge gender disparities. So just take, for example, women in pain are much more likely to get sedatives, while men are much more likely to get actual pain medication. So we have many examples of disparities in our healthcare system, and that is an ongoing quest that we need to keep improving and closing those gaps. In the last year, we have spent an enormous amount of time fighting the legislative repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which would have taken away coverage from millions of people and really increased the financial burden that many families in this country face. We are still fighting to protect the ACA, but the administration that we have now is using all sorts of regulatory ways to actually undermine that coverage. And they couldn't get where they wanted to go on outright repeal of the law, so instead they're doing what we would refer to as regulatory sabotage. So we have a huge amount of work to do. Healthcare is an extraordinarily important piece of the puzzle that goes into women being able to achieve equity and all families being able to achieve economic security in this country.
Well, Deborah, sometimes, you know, when I'm thinking about that, I think it seems like we've made progress on the policy side. We also made a lot of progress just on the science side, right? I think we would say mm-hmm. we have far safer,
absolutely.
Far more effective methods of contraception than we ever had before, safer ways of getting them to women. But without the Affordable Care Act and some of the changes that came along that people aren't always so mindful of, like the equal treatment of women in terms of the cost of health insurance, the inability to exclude people for pre-existing conditions or charge them significantly higher amounts, these are big things that I'm not sure the public still realizes how much of a gain this represented for women. And I wonder if you could speak about those two issues specifically.
I'll say that women are, by definition, pretty disadvantaged by the fact that they are both the primary users of health care because of their reproductive health systems and because they live longer. They use more services than men. They tend to be more prone to certain chronic diseases. But prior to the ACA, they were automatically charged more for the health care coverage that they needed. So just by virtue of being a woman, you were automatically charged more for an insurance plan than men were. That became illegal under the ACA. Another thing that happened under the ACA is that there was no longer the possibility of plans capping your coverage at a certain amount. So imagine if you're a woman with cancer and you get pretty far into your treatment, you've had surgery, now you're supposed to have chemo or radiation, and your plan tells you that, sorry, you've now exhausted your benefits and you're out of luck. That was a terrible tragedy for many women and men as well. Pre-existing conditions hit women particularly hard because they were including in that definition of pre-existing conditions things like cesarean section. So if you had a C-section, you were considered somebody who had a pre-existing condition. If you had been the victim of domestic violence, they were considering that a pre-existing condition. It was getting to the point where the costs for women to get health care were out of sight. And another thing that the ACA did, it said if you're a health plan, you have to cover certain basic benefits, certain categories of coverage. And that was really specifically important to women because one of the things that health plans would often leave out of their coverage, especially on the individual market, was maternity care. So in the individual market, if a woman wanted a plan with maternity care, usually they were priced so high they were unaffordable, or they had things like a $17,000 deductible before you even got any reimbursement. So it made maternity coverage out of reach. So all of those were important gains we made through the ACA. It really put guardrails on what plans could and couldn't do, and it really meant that when you were getting coverage, you were going to get meaningful coverage, and it would be coverage that wasn't discriminatory. The ACA has a provision in it saying that you cannot discriminate against people based on their gender, but also based on their race or ethnicity or sexual identity or disability. And that was going on. And it's one of the reasons why we're working so hard to preserve the protections mm-hmm. in the ACA.
We're speaking today with Deborah Ness, president of the National Partnership for Women and Families, a nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy group dedicated to promoting fairness in the workplace and access to quality health care for all. Deborah, I was thinking as you were saying you're working hard, you have been working hard on so many fronts, and I was amazed to know that you were also, the organization was a key player in the passage of the HITECH Act. Over this past 10 years, there's been this incredible transition from paper records to electronic health records. And I'm wondering if you could talk to our listeners about the role you played and continue to play as we watched the health industry move into the digital age. And why was this so important to your organization's overall goals?
So we have been involved in that as a policy advocate. We formed a coalition of many diverse consumer groups to work with us on this issue. And we had a lot of influence as the HITECH Act was rolled out in helping to shape the policies and focus of that law. We believed it was really important, first and foremost, for the medical world to come into the modern age. There is no other industry, there is no other sector where we're still doing things on paper. And in fact, healthcare has advanced so much and gotten so complicated, it's very dangerous to be doing everything on paper. So from a safety and quality point of view, think about how important it is that when you go to a doctor in one place for one thing, that there be a record of information that that doctor can easily access to know what other things might be going on in your health record that would be important for him or her to know. Medication interactions, whether or not you've had certain tests, whether you have other kinds of conditions. Having the right information at your fingertips when you're treating somebody is really critically important. It's a question of safety. It's also a question of coordination. I think probably anybody who's had to use the healthcare system for any kind of serious illness or has helped somebody use the healthcare system knows that it's still a pretty fragmented system, and often one hand doesn't know what the other is doing. And that means it becomes the patient's responsibility or a caregiver's responsibility to tote paper records from one doctor to another. Think about the burden and amount of error that can creep into the process when you get to an appointment and that doctor doesn't have the right information in front of them. And it also causes enormous costs to the system and hassle. how many people get repeat tests or unnecessary procedures or wrong diagnoses because nobody had the information that was going to tell them what had already been done with that patient. Think about the cost to the patient, to the system, to the employer or the government, and think about the burden in today's busy world of people trying to do all this coordination and communicating or getting their doctors to communicate with each other without having digital records. So we knew that from a safety, a quality, a burden, and a cost perspective, mm-hmm. it was important to move in this direction. And we also knew that we live in a world where people increasingly are being asked to make decisions, tough decisions, mm-hmm. about their health care and actually put a lot of money into their own health care. And so you want to know what's going on with you. You have a right to know, like, why is the doctor making certain recommendations? What's the best way you can take care of yourself? All of that comes with having better access to information, and that only comes if we can get things digitalized.
You know, Deborah, another area where there's been progress but more work needed and that your organization has dedicated a concerted effort is the whole issue of medical and family leave protections for tens of millions of American workers and their families. And of course, this is especially true for low-wage workers and just creates such a hardship for young families with newborns or family caregivers to not have access to paid sick leave. And I know that you have been able to make some progress in a number of states to provide vulnerable workers with paid sick leave. Tell us about those efforts and some of the successes you've achieved and what you think is on the horizon for progress on that front.
Well, it's absolutely true. We live in a world where most adults work. We have many one-parent or two-parent families where everybody who's an adult is working. And there come times when people get sick or an emergency happens and people need time in order to either take care of themselves or their loved ones. And we're really proud of being the group that passed the Family and Medical Leave Act now 25 years ago. But that was unpaid leave. And still, the people who really needed to use it, so many of them can't afford to take it because it's unpaid. It also only covers about half the workforce because it only covers large employers. So what do you do when you get sick or you need preventive health care or your kids need to get immunized? What do you do when your child is sick and has a fever? If you're somebody who's in a low-wage job where you're unlikely to have any paid sick days at all, and that's like 80% of low-wage workers don't have a single paid sick day, you're often making a choice between whether you stay home with your sick child or you potentially lose part of your paycheck or your job. And we hear stories about that all the time. So we are fighting for people to have the right, no matter what kind of job they're in, to earn paid sick days. And right now, we're so pleased to say that we have been successful in 9 states, plus the District of Columbia, and 32 local jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. So we're making progress, but we really need a national paid sick days law. And the other thing we need is paid family and medical leave, so that when it's more than the need for just a couple of paid sick days, but really a longer-term illness or more serious issue with you or your loved one, we really all need the ability to take paid family and medical leave when there's a crisis. And again, we've made progress in some states. We have 5 states that will have paid state leave laws of their own, but that's still a far cry from everybody in this country, and it's why we need to pass something called the Family Act, which would guarantee paid family and medical leave for everybody.
So, Deborah, listening to the great work that you're doing, I'm sure others who are listening to the show are wondering, how can I fight alongside the National Partnership for Women and Families? Tell us about the how people engage your organization and how they might join in on the causes.
Well, I would say please come to our website, nationalpartnership.org. There's lots of information. There's lots of opportunities for action, and we'd love for you to sign up for our emails, and we'll put you to work. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPWF.
Perfect.
So we would love for folks to look us up and join with us.
Great. We've been speaking today with Deborah Ness, president of the National Partnership for Women and Families, a nonprofit, nonpartisan advocacy group that's dedicated to promoting fairness in the workplace and access to quality health care for all. You can learn more about their work by going to nationalpartnership.org or follow them on Twitter at NPWF. Deborah, thank you for your advocacy, for your work, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thank you so much, Margaret and Mark. It's been a pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
This week, we'll turn to the public health issue of guns. Our readers asked us if the Obama administration had legalized bump stocks for semi-automatic rifles, as President Trump claimed in a tweet. Well, no federal law explicitly addresses bump stocks. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives ruled 10 times between 2008 and 2017 that certain models could not be prohibited under existing gun laws. A bump stock is a device that can be attached to the rear of a semi-automatic rifle to make it shoot almost as fast as a fully automatic weapon. The devices became part of the gun debate in October after 64-year-old Stephen Paddock used AR-style rifles affixed with bump stocks to shoot people attending an outdoor concert in Las Vegas, killing more than 50 people. Whether bump stocks are legal depends on how exactly different models function. At issue is whether the devices meet the definition of machine gun under federal firearm laws, which have prohibited, with some exceptions, the transfer and possession of a machine gun since 1986. Federal law defines a machine gun as a weapon that, quote, shoots, is designed to shoot, or can be readily restored to shoot automatically more than one shot without manual reloading by a single function of the trigger. It's true that under Obama, the ATF ruled that it could not prevent the use of certain models of bump stocks, but it also made a similar ruling in April 2017 under the Trump administration. Some bump stocks have been deemed illegal, such as the Atkins Accelerator in a 2006 ruling, because it was determined to meet the single pull of the trigger definition of a machine gun. The ATF in late March proposed a rule to clarify that a machine gun does include bump stock type devices. The public comment period ends June 27th. Gun rights groups and advocates, however, have said that any final rule could be challenged in court. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Each year, more than 1 million babies die at birth, and another 3 million die within the first few weeks of life, often from preventable causes. And when babies are born prematurely, the risks escalate. Newborns, and particularly preemies, have a considerable amount of difficulty regulating their own body temperature, and without access to incubators, babies in the third world often succumb to hypothermia. That got former Stanford MBA student Jane Chen thinking, how do we develop a low-cost solution to the problem?
My team and I realized what was needed was a local solution, something that could work without electricity, that was simple enough for a mother or a midwife to use, given that the majority of births still take place in the home. We needed something that was portable, something that could be sterilized and reused across multiple babies, and something ultra-low-cost compared to the $20,000 that an incubator in the U.S. costs.
Speaking at a recent TED Talk, Chen said that they developed a cocoon-like device called, simply, Embrace, a thermal body wrap that encases the baby and helps regulate body temperature for up to 6 hours.
What you see here looks nothing like an incubator. It looks like a small sleeping bag for a baby. It's waterproof. There's no seams inside, so you can sterilize it very easily. But the magic is in this pouch of wax. It's a wax-like substance with a melting point of human body temperature. You can melt this simply using hot water, and then when it melts, it's able to maintain one constant temperature for 4 to 6 hours at a time. And it creates a warm microenvironment for the baby.
And Chen and her developers have managed to keep the cost of the Embrace baby warmer at around $25 per unit. Since launching the product in 2010, they estimate that over 150,000 babies' lives may have been saved with the device. The Embrace infant warmer has earned numerous international awards for design and efficacy, a low-cost, high-tech, portable temperature regulator designed to regulate preemies' body temperatures to ensure that they not only survive premature birth, but ultimately thrive as well. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.